In this video, we are going to be talking about Cries and Whispers from 1972, which was Ingmar Bergman's films that he wrote and directed, and it starred Ingrid Fuhlin, Harriet Anderson, and of course, Liv Ullmann, and as well as Carrie Solan, Anders Ek, and Erland Josephson. My guest today is Ron Getz, who used to work for the AFI, and he's worked in film for the last 45 years. And he also met Bergman and Liv Ullmann and got to work with them. So I'm excited to jump into that and hear all about it. So Ron, welcome. Thank you for joining me today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
How did you come to meet him to begin with? So you're at the AFI, and what happened here?
Well, my job was directing public programs, and AFI doesn't do this anymore, but at the time, they did seminars, workshops, film series in cities around the country, and it was my job to coordinate and direct that. So one day I get a call from Jean Furstenberg, who at the time was the director of the AFI, and she said, "I have a favor to ask." I said, "Sure." And she said, "I've been asked to help present an award in Dallas, Texas. And I know that's one of the cities you work in. I can't make it. Would you go in my stead?" And I said, "Sure." I said, what's the award for?" And she said, "Well, it's to Ingmar Bergman." And I said, "He's going to be there?" And she said, "Yeah." And I nearly fell off my chair. I mean, I don't think she had any idea. He was my artistic hero. And I never dreamed I would meet him. So I said, "Sure." And so I went and spent about 3 days with him while he received this award. And he also taught some classes or did, you know, conversations with students at Southern Methodist University. So that was sort of how I met him. And through that experience, I then got to know Liv Ullmann and others of his, you know, kind of cast and crew. So it sort of opened his whole world to me.
Was this, so what year are we talking here? This is mid 70s, like
80. So it's, he was just in the process. He was finishing up Fanny and Alexander. So it hadn't been released yet. And I suspect he was paid for this to get this award because he never does things like that. And he was frankly a little hard up for cash. So I think that's why he did it. And it was very unusual. I don't think he ever shows up to get awards.
Yeah, I never heard of him doing anything like that in the past.
Yeah.
And, you know, tell me about what it was like meeting him. I mean, because you said you were already a huge fan and a hero. So what was going through your mind and feelings before that? Were you just so nervous or what was that like?
Oh, I was terrified. And I think I had a preconceived notion that probably a lot of people have, that, you know, I was going to meet this dour, serious, kind of withdrawn Swedish genius. And when I get there, I mean, it was kind of a surreal experience because he got the full Texas treatment. So a limo pulls up with Longhorn steer horns on it, and out comes Ingmar Bergman and his wife, Ingrid. And he comes over and I'm introduced, and I'm just kind of like, you know, a blabbering idiot. And he puts his arm around me and we just chat and laugh. And he was like the warmest, touchiest person that I've ever, you know, had the experience of working with, and not at all what I expected. And not at all what I think most people think of when they think of him.
That's it. That's so, I love hearing that because when you look at his films that are so emotional, and particularly the films he was doing in the 60s and 70s were very dark as well, dark side and cynical. And you would think that this man must be, I mean, he certainly had his dark side, but when you watch him on set sometimes, like even on Cries and Whispers, there's that half an hour footage of him on set and everyone's having a great time.
Had a wonderful time. Yeah.
it's so fascinating to me that he was always in high spirits and he had this real sense of humor about him. You didn't see that as much in his movies, but it's good to hear that he was a warm person. And then how did Liv Ullmann come into this?
Initially, I worked for the AFI at the Kennedy Center in Washington, D.C. And she was, I learned she was going to be in a play there. Ibsen's Ghosts.
Oh, okay.
And with Kevin Spacey in his first, in a very supporting role back before he was known. Anyway, so I found out she was going to do that because I had this connection through Bergman. I was able to get in touch with her manager and offered, I said, we would like to do a tribute to her film work while she's doing this play. And we would set it up as showing several of her films and then I would do an interview with her. And they all agreed. So that's how that got started. And then after AFI shut that operation down and moved everything to California, she was doing something in Hollywood and was invited to do an interview with students at the Center for Advanced Film Studies, which is the AFI campus there. And by that time I had moved out there. So because I knew her and had done this before, they asked me to do the interview again.
And what was, again, was, I mean, I imagine she was someone you also admired her being in so many Bergman films.
Yeah.
Was that also a nerve-wracking experience?
Yeah, a bit. And she's a very, very dear woman. But there were things I learned about her that I didn't expect. She has a very simple view of Ingmar Bergman's films, including the ones she was in. In her mind, they're just stories. So what I love about Bergman is how, you know, he uses these stories to delve into very deep and complicated issues. And for her, that's like, I was surprised by that.
Yeah, I am too, yeah.
And, you know, I started off in the first interview with her asking her about Persona, which was her first film with him. And I said, you know, how did you prepare for that? Were you, you know, given how many issues are dealt with in that? And she kind of looked puzzled. She goes, you know, it was just Ingmar's strange story about these two women who exchange personality. She goes, I didn't really get it, but I just did what I was told. And then I don't know what I expected. I think I kind of naively thought that she would be, you know, part of that, you know, creation. And for her, it's like, no, I did what I was told. And it was just a story I didn't quite get.
That's interesting. Did she also say that about like the other films? Like, because, you know, Scenes from a Marriage, obviously she has so much dialogue, whereas Persona, she didn't say anything. Did she expand on the working relationship or was she very vague?
Well, it's funny. I've learned, I've also talked with Harriet Anderson too.
Oh.
I met her at the Berlin Film Festival. This was after Bergman died and they did the first retrospective of his work after his death. So there were a lot of Bergman folks there. And they all sort of are the same in that they weren't involved in sort of anything except the story.
Right.
And doing what they were told. I mean, both of them would say things like, they would kind of poo-poo this idea of like Daniel Day-Lewis, who gets in character and stays in character, and for the whole, you know, they goes, no, you don't, that's not, I show up, right. I do what I'm told, and we trust Ingmar to tell us how to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it really changed my perspective of what that kind of collaboration was. And I don't mean to denigrate them in any way, but I think he was able to pull things out of them, unlike any other directors. I mean, when you look at Liev Ullmann's career, except for Jan Troell, she really hasn't had successful films.
That's true.
It's Bergman and Jan Troell are the ones who were able to pull that out of her.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of true of his other actresses too.
Yeah.
And,
yeah, it's a good point, because I you know, often other, like Ingrid Thulin, you know, of course, you know, she was in The Damned, Visconti's The Damned, and other films, but it almost seems as if their career is so stamped amongst Bergman films that I can't even really think of anything else. I know that they are in things, but nothing where the performance shone like they did at these films.
Yeah, and it's interesting how he directed them. There are some glimpses, there are some documentaries that show him directing.
Yes.
But in some cases, I was surprised to see this. He would show them exactly what he wanted.
I noticed that.
And, you know, I think most American actors might balk at that.
Yeah, oh, for sure, yeah.
And then I know, speaking of Cries and Whispers, Harriet Anderson says that he even showed her and made the sounds of that she should make when she's dying. But then there were times, and there's another famous scene with Liev Ullmann, I think it's from The Passion of Anna, where he told her, he said, when you do this scene, I want you to focus on your lips. I want you to put all of your focus there. And she said, I didn't get why, but I did what I was told. Mm-hmm. And you see that scene, you can see this, her skin changes. I mean, and she said, it was because I did what I was told.
Right.
And didn't get it, didn't know why, but that I'm just kind of amazed by that. And I think especially with these actresses that he had personal relationships with, he knew them so well. He knew what to say to get things out of them.
Because having that intimate relationship with them as well, I imagine he knew them I don't want to say inside and out, but I'm sure he knew them a lot better than other directors would have known them.
Yeah, and it's a lot of them. I mean, it's Harriet Anderson, B.B. Anderson, Liev Ullmann. I don't think Ingrid Thulin was ever...
I don't think so.
But, you know, he tended to have affairs with his actresses.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that, I mean, when you watch the performances, they're so organic, they're so spontaneous, they're so deep and raw, and it's hard to believe that he was so specific with telling them exactly what to do. And you're right, I got that impression watching some of those documentaries, that, like, he was moving their hands where to go. Even in Cries and Whispers, he was everything from how to put the sheets over Harriet Anderson's bodies, and I thought, I was like, he can't have been telling them that specifically what to do, because how can these performances be that great? But they are. So I don't know, you know, it's a mystery.
And I think they would say that too.
Right.
That I asked Liev Ullmann about that. I've seen other interviews with different actresses of his being asked, you know, what is that? And they can't really answer it. And what they come back to is, we just trust him so much that we do what he tells us. And we know that it's going to be the best we can do.
Did you get to talk more about his work at all, or was it just
very bit. Kind we of... would have, you know, periodic conversations during those 3 days. And one thing I ask, and I sort of knew the answer, but I wanted to see if it had changed. And I said, you know, of your work, are there films that you're most happy with, you know, that you feel like it's the best I could have done? And he consistently singled out two, Persona and Cries and Whispers. And I think I would agree with that. I think what he meant is they best fulfilled the vision I had when I started making it.
Right.
And I think you feel that. There's just sort of a confidence in that this is exactly what he wanted.
So, you know, jumping into Cries and Whispers, yeah. Do you remember the first time you saw this, how you felt about it initially?
Yeah, and I have to, you know, when I first saw Persona, I was stunned, but more perplexed. It was so different from what preceded it. I didn't quite know what to make of it. It took a couple times before it worked, you know, it hit me. Where with Cries and Whispers, I was just so stunned by the technical part of it. I mean, it's beautiful. I mean, mm-hmm. and these faces, I mean, it's almost all shot in close up. And there's so much mystery in it, you know, that you and the sound, you hear these, you know, cries and whispers in the right. background as these women either reveal their past or a dream. It's kind of hard to tell sometimes.
Yeah.
But I was stunned by it when I saw it. And it's disturbing. I mean, Harriet Anderson's death is just hard to watch. I've probably seen it more than a dozen times now. And I just watched it again the other night just to refresh myself.
Yeah, me too.
And it's hard. It's hard to watch.
It really is. Yeah. I remember when I first saw it feeling almost scared of it. Like not because it was partly about the fact that this woman was dying, but just watching the death unfold. And I know that the story is much more, there's a bigger picture than simply about a woman dying, but I don't know how Harriet Anderson found that. I know that she said she saw her father die, and I think he had cancer. So the sound, and as you said, Bergman even was illustrating some of those sounds, but just the deep breathing and the pain, that one scene where she calls Anna in and she's hugging him and then pushes her away just to let out a big scream of anguish. And then Liv Ullmann can't even hear it. She covers her ears. It's astonishing. What would you say the film is truly about? What do you think the essence of the story is?
Ah, gee.
It's hard to say in a nutshell, but.
Yeah. You know, I think if you look at the very last scene with the sisters on the swing, and this is basically from Agnes's diary, talking about, you know, at least this moment, I can say I experienced perfection. I mean, something like that.
Yeah.
And I kind of think for Bergman, it's, you know, life is horrible, but you find those moments
right.
that give it meaning and worth it all. I mean, that if I had to sum it up, that might be what I think the overall theme is. There are many other things in
it. Yeah.
And there are many other influences. I mean, one of the things that I think really influenced this film is Edvard Munch. The Scream, and he did a whole series of paintings called the Death Room, but it's basically photos paintings of women in this kind of situation, and a lot of red. So, you know, I think we always have to remember Bergman is influenced by his larger Scandinavian heritage. And I think that's where Munch shows up most and as an influence on his work.
Yeah, no, definitely. Because I mean, that it's such a stylized film in a lot of ways. But I mean, that use of red is just, it's just everywhere. The carpets, the walls. I know people have had different interpretations as to what that may mean. I mean, I think it's really, you know, I think blood plays an aspect of this. You know, of course, the scene with Ingrid Thulin, which is so hard to watch, you know, where she, I don't even want to repeat it. People, I'm sure, know what I'm talking about. It's so disturbing. And of course, the suicide attempt by Liv Ullmann's husband. So they all, you know, they're all haunted by the past, but their past has blood on their hands, so to speak. And having almost like inhaled the sense of distance between them, the sense of having a mother that was cold, that was distant, that was critical, very much like Bergman, as Bergman described about his mother was. And I think even she even, they even dress Liv Ullmann, plays the mother as well, very much like his mother. Very much like his mother was. And it's so devastating to see what's happened with these three sisters, that they can't even touch each other. They can't even really communicate with each other. And you're right in the sense that this mystery, because he doesn't give you necessarily the psychology as to why that is, which I I like that ambiguity. And I imagine it really has something to do with, you know, the mother was closer to one or two of them as opposed to one of the other daughters. Perhaps that created a rift, a competition. And I think it had a lot to do with the men they were with. I mean, you see Ingrid Thulin is with this man who's so unemotional, hates emotion, doesn't talk, is cold as ice. Maybe she was attracted to that initially because it was familiar ground for her. And I think, you know, when she cuts her vagina, you know, I really saw that as, you're not going to touch me again. You know, I know that people have had different metaphors about that. I can't always get my head around what I've read. I see that really as something as much more psychological, much more of a rooted in not wanting to be touched, because the touching plays such a part in this. I mean, what do you think that lack of affection, the touching really represented in your eyes?
Well, it's been suggested that that those women are really intentionally representing different sides of Bergman's mother.
Right.
And he certainly has mother issues.
Oh, definitely.
You know, he did a film, not for himself. It wasn't released in it, but called Karin's Face. And it's just a study of his mother's face and photographs.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, I think I found it somewhere. So I have seen it. But anyway, I think that's Bergman's own background. And it's interesting that I found him to be so touchy when I met him.
Right.
But I think as a child, both his parents were kind of staunch. You know, there's a scene in, I think it's presented in Cries and Whispers as Agnes's memory. And she's talking about, I used to watch my mother from afar.
Right.
And you know, I admired her, but, you know, and there was one moment where we were close, and it's when I touched her face.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And I think that's exactly, I think that's Bergman talking. Mm-hmm. About his own mother.
Yeah.
Liv Ullmann, in fact, has said, there was recently an article of it was an interview with her and Jessica Chastain on the occasion of this kind of redo of Scenes from Marriage. But she said, you know, with Bergman, all these someone, one of the questions was, why was he so good at working with women? Mm-hmm. And she said, well, they're all him. It's him touching, getting in touch with his own feminine side, because he feels that men can't be that emotional. They can't reveal themselves the way women can.
Right.
So I think there is a case to be made that almost all these women are in many ways Bergman.
Yeah.
And I think in Cries and Whispers that, you know, some of those, you know, that scene again with the young Agnes and her mother, that's right out of things Bergman has written about his own mother.
Right. Yeah, because he had such cold and distant and really abusive parents. I mean, you saw in Hour of the Wolf, when Max von Sydow, as he's talking about his father locking him in a closet, and that's very much what happened to him. So,
and that's, you know, exactly. And that same story shows up later in Face to Face, by the way.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah.
And one of her hysterical scenes, she talks about being locked, you know, in a closet. And that's his own experience.
Yeah. I mean, he certainly was, you know, both emotionally and physically abused by his parents. And it certainly shows up, you know, so much in his work. Another thing I find fascinating about it is actually the lack of dialogue. I mean, there is a lot of dialogue, but his films are always so dialogue heavy. Very much his theater background played a real influence in his cinematic world. And there's a lot less of this. I think like the first 9 minutes, there's not even any dialogue. And it's so much about what's happening between the people within those silences. And the silences say so much. You don't even need any dialogue. I mean, that dinner scene with Ingrid Thulin and her husband, I think there's like one or two lines there, but it speaks volumes as to what is happening and where the marriage has gone. What I really find interesting is that Ingrid Thulin, when she does have that breakthrough with Liv Ullmann, when she's trying to be affectionate with her and reach out, and she begins to cry because she's so afraid of touch and affection, but she mentions this guilt. And I wonder, having this Catholic upbringing, of course, that plays a role in this as well. I think the guilt for me really lied in the fact that the marriage had failed, or it, you know, they're not divorced, but that in her mind, it failed in so many ways. And to a Catholic person or religious person, and this is, you know, 19th century, it's vague about what the exact date is, but something like the 19th century would have been so scarring for anyone. I mean, is that something that popped out to you at all?
Yeah, I think that, and the fact that, you know, women were so clearly defined. I mean, and had a very restrictive role.
Right.
And if you didn't fit that in any way, I'm sure there was guilt.
Yes. Yeah. Which I that's another thing that has been talked about a lot in this film, about how they're all oppressed in one way, shape, or form. Mm-hmm. And what was interesting, was a little different with Liv Ullmann, was that she was more in touch with her sexuality, like with the affair with Erland Josephson. Mm-hmm. And I was curious what you thought of that scene when she's trying to seduce him and he brings her to the mirror and starts to point out, you know, the some of the lines underneath her eyes. And I couldn't figure out what he was trying to explain to her. She says, well, I think you're talking about yourself. What did you think that scene was about?
Well, I think it's a brilliant scene. I mean, just technically, if nothing else.
Right.
Where he essentially reads her face.
Right.
And I think ultimately her conclusion is right. We're the same. That's why we're shallow. We're selfish.
Right.
All those things. And I think that's kind of what brought them together, and perhaps why he then thought, you need to see this. You need to know who you are.
Right.
And I think maybe from his perspective, he goes, I'm trying not to be that now anymore.
Right.
I don't know. It's hard to say, but I just think it's a brilliant kind of scene. So an implied past.
Yes.
That they had a past. We don't know necessarily what that fully was.
Right.
And, you know, was it, you know, what did she then tire of him and brush him aside? And now she's bored and has an opportunity. And I don't know.
Yeah.
A lot of possibilities there.
There really is. And that's what I like. Every time I watch this, I think I've only seen it 3 or 4 times, but every time I see it, I see so much more, or I reflect on so many things that he doesn't tell you, which I really appreciate. Also, the relationship between Harriet Anderson and Anna, who, you know, she's like the housemaid or nurse of the house. And this is really fascinating because on the one hand, it's suggested that they may be lovers. They may have been lovers. I mean, every time she needs help, she calls only Anna, and Anna's touch and her affection calms her. And, you know, you see she even takes her clothes off. And I thought it could be part sexual, but possibly part of the fact that Anna had lost a child. So almost mothering her to an extent. What did you think of that relationship?
A little of both. You know, it's interesting. If you look at kind of the body of his work, there are often these sort of homoerotic moments.
Yeah.
Between women,
right.
You know, it's in Persona, it's in Cries and Whispers, it's in The Silence, it's, and it's interesting. There's a scholar who's really focused on that, and he was telling me he interviewed Lee Volman, was asking her about that, and she absolutely denies.
That
there's any kind of sexual thing there. Among these women, and it's like, I think it's kind of hard to deny.
How can you deny that she takes her clothes off when she goes? It's like, come on. Why did you think that Liv Ullmann was, you know, they have this breakthrough of affection at one point with her and Ingrid Fulin? It's quite a beautiful scene, and then in the end she seems to reject that. She seems to be cold and distant and almost act like nothing had happened. And I was curious why you thought he would have ended it that way.
Well, I think her character is selfish and frivolous, and she acknowledges that. And I think she tires of things. I think, and maybe it goes back to the whole scene with the doctor too. Maybe she previously tired of him and now she's bored. And, you know, I get the feeling that's sort of how she lives her life. That, you know,
I can
see that was yesterday. You know, I've moved on. You know, I have other priorities. I don't want to be called to account for what I've said in the past. I think she says that, in fact. So I think it's part of that character that's, and again, you know, all these women in some ways are sort of stereotypes, or, you know, maybe they're archetypes. I don't know. But again, I think from Bergman's perspective, they're all part of his mother. You know, she could be frivolous and selfish. She could be cold and distant. She could, you know, so it's hard sometimes to think of them as fully developed characters or women. They're kind of parts of women.
Yeah, I could certainly see that. I also thought perhaps maybe Bergman didn't trust that it's that simple to suddenly change the relationship and move it forward that drastically, that fast, which is a more of a Hollywood convention. You know, it's like character arcs and they change and things look a little too easy. And I think because they've had such a distant relationship for so many years, even though they've had this moment of breaking through that, it's not going to be that easy tomorrow. It's because they're so used to this distance that it's built into them so much. You can't mm-hmm. just break out of it. So it's somewhat hopeful, I think, because Ingrid Thulin clearly was hurt by what Liv Ullmann was saying and was mm-hmm. reminding her that they, you know, that they touched, that they were affectionate with each other. And I don't know. I mean, you know, you hope that Liv Ullmann's character will grow, but it's a mix of cynicism and optimism. But I think he was just being realistic about it. I don't know what you think. Mm-hmm.
No, I would agree with that. You know, the other thing about that scene where the breakthrough scene, where suddenly the dialogue disappears and it's just music and right. these hands touching faces.
Yes, yeah.
It's such a sensual
it
experience.
Is. Yeah.
And also with that cello mm-hmm. music. Mm-hmm. Bergman's also talked about that music was essential to his creation of Cries and Whispers. And I'm not sure that's something you would necessarily automatically get, but he talks about that a lot with a number of his films, that they're really influenced by music.
Right.
And it's also interesting that Kabi Larrate, one of his previous wives, is the musician who plays the piano in that, and also in Face to Face, and right. so he continues to have these relationships.
His whole family and past lovers are in everything. I think even yeah. his current wife is in this, in the flashbacks with the mother. She's in it like it's a very small
yeah.
part.
Yeah.
And his oldest daughter's in it. It's yeah. It's really interesting that I can understand having like family and stuff, but it's like ex-lover and another ex-lover.
Yes.
And I'm like, isn't that awkward?
Well, and later life, they would all get together and have like these big family reunions
yeah.
and they'd all yeah. be there. And I always marveled at that. I thought, yeah, that's hard to imagine.
It really is. And I imagine because they had a deep creative connection with it. Yeah. And I think that clearly was what was pushing it forward. I think without that, you know, I doubt it would be, they would have some kind of common ground, but I've always been fascinated by that. The other scene that is really interesting, and you're not too sure if this is a nightmare or a dream or, I know Harry Anderson has talked about it and has a hard time making sense of it herself. And because they go into everyone's history and only touch on Anna's history with the fact that her daughter had died
yeah.
and she's praying in that one scene. But suddenly when it seems like it's her turn, you know, he would kind of go do a close up and the whole frame would be red and you hear that little bell and then it would go into like a flashback. In her case, it felt like a dream of hers because, you know, they're at the mm-hmm. Harriet Anderson, who's dead, but is now talking.
Yes.
Is she's dead, but she's alive, you know, and she can't go until her sisters touch her or are affectionate with her. And they mm-hmm. all reject her, of course, except Anna. And Liv Ullmann says something interesting, which is, well, my husband needs me. And when her husband needed her earlier in the film, when he tried to commit suicide, she walks away.
Yeah.
So they make these excuses. And I wondered what that really is about. I mean, I think, again, for me, it's just that Bergman knows that the past haunts you and that it's not so easy to make up and people die with a lot of loose ends. You know, I don't yeah. know what you thought.
Well, and it's also, I think we have to keep in mind, this is Anna's dream or fantasy.
It's hard to say.
So I think she's seeing it, you know, as, you know, those nasty sisters can't give her what I've been able to give her, which is, you know, real love and comfort. And so that's kind of what I took from it, is it's her, again, whether it's a fantasy or a dream. In fact, I think there's when she's talking to the dead Agnes, she says something about, you know, rest, it's just a dream. And I think Agnes says, well, maybe for you it's a dream, but it's not for me.
Right.
Which is also something that shows up in a number of his
films. Yes. Yeah.
That, you know, it may be your dream, but it's not mine.
Right.
So I kind of think it, in some ways, it's Anna's projection of her feelings for both Agnes and the sisters.
I can see that. Yeah. That makes the most sense to me. And the scene with the priest is also really interesting. And he seems at first to just be saying what, you know, giving last rites. But then when you see him get emotional, and then and as he says, they were very close. I wonder why he thought that was, that why I love the scene. I wonder why he felt the need to have that scene, other than to show that Harriet was a woman of strong faith. Again, the question is why. So I was curious what you thought that was about. No, I mean, the priest also. Really, yeah, sorry, go ahead.
I think it's a wonderful scene. And yeah, I think it echoes Bergman's own religious feelings.
Right.
And it also echoes almost an identical situation in Winter Light with this doubting priest.
Yes.
Yeah. And, you know, it's so amazing. The priest goes, if it be so, and it's sort of all these ifs, you know, if this, you know, if that, then pray for us who are left, I think I got this right, who are left here on this cruel earth under a cold and empty sky.
Right.
I think that kind of sums up Bergman's religious views. Mm-hmm. And I think this was one more chance to kind of put that out there, because he kind of put that aside.
Yes.
He hadn't been, you know, he sort of dealt with that. And I thought, here's another chance to say, here's the view I still hold of religion.
Right.
Which may have changed at the end of his life.
Yeah. I've read that as well.
Yeah.
I mean, the cinematography in this is just gorgeous. And one thing I notice is that when Harriet Anderson dies, there's sun on her face. And then when she dies, it goes away.
Yes.
Yeah.
I know. I thought that was, again, brilliant on Sven-Nykvist's part.
Yes.
And what I hadn't realized, because I just didn't know the technical stuff so much, is it's hard to shoot red.
Oh, yeah.
It's really hard. And he spent a lot of time, you know, testing different things to be able to get the red that deep, and but also be able to have complexions that didn't look red. So it was a real technical achievement, too. Mm-hmm. The other thing, too, is that, and I find this remarkable both from the cinematographer's point of view, but from the actor's point of view, to act in that kind of space where you're having to be in this frame.
Yeah.
And you need to know where your mark is, and you're moving in that frame. That's a big technical challenge, to be
really
able
hard.
To act at the same time that you're making your marks.
Yeah.
That's hard.
Oh yeah. Yeah, I know it really is. I wondered if he I think he was very particular even about his blocking. I wonder if he gave them any freedom in that regard. I don't think so.
I doubt it.
Yeah.
I doubt it. And what I've wondered is how much did they rehearse?
Right.
Because I would think to get at that right, you'd have to rehearse a lot.
I think they did. Yeah. I think his stage influence always played such a big role in his films. Was there anything else about Cries and Whispers you wanted to mention?
You know, one thing, this was his most successful film commercially and critically in a long time. And he had two pretty major failures just before that, The Touch and The Right.
Right.
And so he needed a success. What astounded me when I was reading through, you know, production stuff, the production budget for this was $500,000. I mean, that's
Wow. That's, that's, I think they all worked for free, right? They got a cut.
And they did. I think profits. All the actors in Nykvist, contributed their salaries until they saw, you know, the success, and it was successful.
And he was, it's funny that of all people to distribute it in the States was Roger Corman, whose movies are nothing Bergman's. And there's a little featurette on the Criterion Channel with him. I'm not sure if you saw it, but they put this in drive-ins.
Yes.
To think that you went to a drive-in in the fall. And apparently it didn't do major business at the drive-in, but it did average. And that was apparently good enough and made Bergman happy. I find that I find it interesting that Corman loved a lot of these art films in European cinema, but rarely made anything hold a candle to it.
The flip side of that too is that Bergman likes schlock too.
That's true.
In fact, one of the reasons that he wanted to go to Dallas, he wanted to go see South Fork, where Dallas was shot.
Oh, wow. Oh, my God. Oh, the show. Oh, wow. That's so interesting to me. Yeah. He certainly referenced some commercial films that he loved, like the James Bond films in the late 60s. Yes. I know he was saying that he loved those. And not long before he passed away, like Ocean's 12 with the Ocean's 11 sequel with Brad Pitt, which to me was such a bad movie. But yeah, you're right. It's it is really fascinating that people's tastes can be so different than what they make. I mean, I know he liked a lot of the great art film directors of the day as well, right? Antonioni and directors like that. But yeah, no, it is interesting to see that he appreciated all kinds of movies, you know. But this is, wow, it's a stunning film. So anyone watching this or listening to this now, go see it. It's on the Criterion Channel, and you can also get either the Blu-ray or the DVD from the Criterion Collection.
Can I just add something to that?
Sure, yeah.
I rarely do this, and I get a lot of crap when I say this. This is probably the only foreign language film I would ever recommend watching in its dubbed version, because it was dubbed under Bergman's direction by all the original actors, and it's so well done. And what it allows you to do then is not have to keep switching to the subtitles. You can just absorb that cinematography and the faces and without having to read.
I didn't even know it was dubbed. There's a dubbed version.
And I think it's in, well, I know when Criterion released it initially, it was in both versions. You could see it dubbed or subtitled.
Right.
I'm assuming in the box set, it must be like that too, but I'm not sure.
I'm not sure either. I'll have to check the Criterion channel. If it's not there, then yeah, you're probably right. It's probably on the physical media copy of it. I had no idea. Yeah, because they all spoke good English too.
Yeah.
Right? So I can see that.
And he dubbed it in such a way that the lips match almost exactly. So
that's interesting.
Again, I never recommend watching dubbed films except this one.
That's interesting. Yeah, no, I would certainly see it, particularly because it was from the actual actors, which is so, I know Sophia Loren also dubbed all her Italian films, so that's but it's very rare, you know, it's very rare, so that's really interesting. If you're listening to this now on the audio version of this podcast, there's only so many episodes on the audio version, so head over to the YouTube channel, youtube.com/Robert Bellissimo at the movies. And if you're watching this on YouTube and you're new to the channel, please consider subscribing. It's absolutely free to do so by clicking the Robert Bellissimo at the Movies logo. You'll see it just above my head here to your top left in just a second. Just click on that and then click the bell in order to get a notification every time I release one of my new episodes. Ron, thank you again for coming. I really appreciate that you took the time to share your experiences with Bergman and Liv Ullmann and your takes on Cries and Whispers. I really enjoyed this. So thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Great. And we'll see everyone soon.